Otto's title of the Great was not undeserved. He had but one ambition, to restore his empire to the power and prosperity it had enjoyed under Charlemagne, and he came close to achieving it. In the 11 years of his reign, spent largely in Italy, he brought to the north a measure of peace unparalleled in living memory. Rome was more of a problem. In the heat generated by constant papal intrigue, Flashpoint was never very far off. And in 966, the emperor was faced with serious riots, which he was able to quell only after he had hanged the prefect of the city by his hair from the equestrian statue of Marcus Aurelius in front of the Lateran. It was in the south, however, that Otto found himself in real difficulties. He knew that he could never control the peninsula while Apulia and Calabria remained in Byzantine hands, but the Greeks' hold on their Italian provinces was too strong for him. When war failed, he tried diplomacy, marrying his son and heir to the lovely Byzantine princess, Theophano. Her dowry was generous, but it did not include South Italy. Otto died a disappointed man. His former allies, the Lombard duchies, were left more powerful than ever, while Apulia and Calabria remained as Greek as ever they had been. Like his hero Charlemagne, Otto the Great was unfortunate in his successors. His son Otto II did his best, but after a hair's breadth escape from a Saracen expeditionary force which had trounced his army in Calabria, he was struck down in 983 at the age of 28 after an overdose of aloes following a fever. He is the only Roman emperor to be buried in St. Peter's. His son, by Theophano, Otto III, proved a strange contrast to his forebears. Combining the ambitions of his line with a romantic mysticism clearly derived from his mother and forever dreaming of a great Byzantinesque theocracy that would embrace Germans, Italians, Greeks, and Slavs, with God at its head and Pope, and Emperor his twin viceroys. This extraordinary youth had hardly left Rome after his imperial coronation when the city rose once again in revolt. But 2 years later, he returned in strength, reestablished order, restored the young German visionary Gregory V to the papacy, and built himself a magnificent palace on the Aventine. Here he passed the remaining years of his life in a curious combination of splendor and aestheticism, surrounded by a court stiff with Byzantine ceremonial, eating in solitude off gold plate, occasionally shedding his purple dalmatic in favor of a pilgrim's cloak and trudging barefoot to some distant shrine. In 999, he elevated his old tutor, Gerbert of Aurillac, to the papacy under the name of Sylvester II. Gerbert was not only a distinguished theologian, he was also the most learned scientist and mathematician of his time, and is generally credited with having popularized Arabic numerals and the use of the astrolabe in the Christian West. For a pope of such caliber, the Romans should have been grateful to the emperor, but Otto tried their patience too hard, and in 1001 they expelled him from the city. He died the following year, leaving, as might have been expected, no issue. He was 22. In Italy at the end of the first millennium, we can find certain patterns already formed, others slowly taking shape. First and most important is the interrelationship of Italy, the papacy, and the Empire of the West. Italy was once again an integral part of the empire, united with Germany under a single ruler, but subordinate in that she had no say in his election. That ruler was thus always a German prince over an Italian. On the other hand, though titular king of the Romans, he could assume a dignity of emperor only after his coronation of the Pope in Rome, and the imperial claim to the right of papal appointment was not generally accepted in Italy, least of all by the Curia and the Roman aristocracy. Even the journey to Rome through Lombardy, Tuscany, and the Papal States could be made difficult for an unpopular candidate. Meanwhile, the free towns of North Italy were growing steadily stronger and more self-willed. The chaos of the 9th and early 10th centuries had given them a taste for independence, and the peace which they had known under the Ottos had favored their commercial development and already made them rich, particularly Milan, the first great crossroads south of the Alpine passes, and the swelling sea republics of Genoa, Pisa, and Venice. This was a characteristically Italian phenomenon. All over Western Europe, the revival of trade and the beginnings of organized industry had set in motion that slow drift from the country to the towns, which still continues today. But in Italy, there was no embryonic concept of nationhood to override that of municipal solidarity. The process was quicker and more self-conscious than elsewhere. For most of the North Italian towns, the emperor was too remote, his local representative too weak or irresponsible to constitute a serious break on their independent development. The result was that the towns continued to take advantage of the growing discord between empire and papacy, some using papal support to sever their allegiance to the emperor, others pledging him, in return for an imperial charter, their constant steadfastness against papal blandishments. Thus, during the 11th and 12th centuries, were born the city-states of Italy, self-governing according to a communal system often consciously based on the Roman model, strong enough both to defend their independence against all comers, including each other, and to exert an increasing gravitational pull on the local landed aristocracy, and thus simultaneously were sown the seeds of that grim conflict later associated with the names of the papalist Guelph and the imperialist Ghibelline, which was to lacerate northern and central Italy for centuries to come. In Rome and the Papal States, the old mixture of turbulence and turpitude still prevailed, as the great rival families, the Crescenti, the Counts of Tusculum, and the rest, circled ceaselessly around the throne of St. Peter. Yet even here and within the Curia itself, a new spirit was beginning to appear, an awakening consciousness of the Church's need, if she were to survive, to shake off the shame of the past century and somehow to regain her intellectual and moral ascendancy. This was the spirit of Cluny, the great French Mother Abbey of Reform. A Cluniac dependency had existed in Rome for the past 50 years. At the outset, it had had little influence. But now, at last, its example and teachings were beginning to take effect. Thus, so far as North and Central Italy were concerned, the overriding tendency, which was to shape the course of events in the 11th century, the quickening of the struggle between an arrogant empire and a resurgent papacy, with the increasingly self-reliant Lombard and Tuscan cities playing off one against the other, was already discernible as the century opened. In the south, on the other hand, the situation in 1000 AD gave no clue to the momentous developments which lay in store. Of the four 10th century protagonists in the region, two had now withdrawn. The Western Empire had shown no further interest since Otto II's debacle, while the Saracens, though continuing their pirate raids from Sicily, seemed to have renounced the idea of establishing permanent settlements on the mainland. This led to a polarization between the two remaining parties, Lombard and Byzantine, whose desultory fighting might have been expected to drag on interminably had they been left to themselves. In the event, however, they were now joined by a race of newcomers from the north, superior alike in courage, energy, and intelligence, by whom they were outclassed and, in little more than 50 years, overthrown. The story of the Normans in South Italy begins around 1015 with a group of about 40 young Norman pilgrims at the shrine of the Archangel Michael on Monte Gargano, that curious rocky excrescence which juts out from what might be called the calf of Italy into the Adriatic. Seeing in this underpopulated, unruly land both an opportunity and a challenge, they were easily persuaded by certain Lombard leaders to remain in Italy as mercenaries with the object of driving the Byzantines from the peninsula. Word soon got back to Normandy, and the initial trickle of adventurous, footloose, younger sons swelled into a steady immigration. Fighting indiscriminately for the highest bidder, they soon began to exact payments in land for their services. In 1030, Duke Sergius of Naples, grateful for their support, invested their leader, Rainulf, with the county of Aversa. Thenceforth, their progress was fast, and in 1053, when Pope Leo IX raised a vastly superior army and led it personally against them, they defeated him on the field of Civitate and took him prisoner. By this time, the supremacy among the Norman chiefs had been assumed by the family of Tancred de Hauteville, an obscure Norman knight from the Cotentin Peninsula, of whose 12 sons 8 had settled in Italy, and 5 were to become leaders of the first rank. After Civitate, papal policy changed, and in 1059, Robert de Hauteville, nicknamed Guiscard the Crafty, was invested by Pope Nicholas II with the dukedoms of Apulia, Calabria, and Sicily. Of these territories, much of Apulia and most of Calabria remained Greek, while Sicily was largely in Saracen hands. But Robert, fortified by his new legitimacy, could not be checked for long. 2 years later, he and his youngest brother, Roger, crossed the Straits of Messina, and for the next decade were able to maintain constant pressure on the Saracens, both in Sicily and on the mainland. Bari fell in 1071, and with it the last remnants of Byzantine power in Italy. Early the next year, Palermo followed, and the Muslim hold on Sicily was broken forever. In 1075 came the collapse of Salerno, the last Lombard principality. By the end of the century, the Normans had annihilated foreign opposition. In all Italy south of the Garigliano River, they reigned supreme, while in Sicily, they were well on their way to establishing the most brilliant and cultivated court of the Middle Ages. The Western emperors of the 11th century were less preoccupied with Italy than the Ottos had been. Neither Henry II, the Holy, nor Conrad II left an appreciable imprint on the peninsula, nor, in all probability, would Conrad's successor, Henry III, have done so, had not the situation in Rome deteriorated to such a point that in 1045, no less than 3 rival popes were squabbling over the papal crown. Henry hurried to Rome and firmly deposed all 3, but his 2 successive nominees lasted less than a year between them. The second, Damascus II, expiring after only 23 days in circumstances that strongly suggested poison. And it was not until December 1048 that a great council of bishops assembled at Worms voted unanimously for the emperor's second cousin, Bishop Bruno of Toul. With Bruno, who took the name Leo IX, the church recovered its self-respect. The dreadful spell that had so long degraded Rome was broken, and though the pope died after only 6 years, it was he whom the Normans captured at Civitate, and he never really recovered from the humiliation. He had already laid the foundations for a reformed and revitalized papacy. In this task, however, he had the wholehearted support of his emperor, an advantage which his own successors were never to enjoy, for with his death in 1054 and Henry's 2 years later, the fleeting era of harmonious cooperation between emperor and pope was at an end. It was the irony of Henry's life that, in striving to build the papacy into an ally, he succeeded only in creating a rival. The church, having regained her virtue, now began to seek power as well, a quest that was bound to bring her into conflict with imperial interest, especially when pursued with the inflexible determination of prelates such as Archdeacon Hildebrand. For nearly 30 years before his election as Pope Gregory VII in 1073, Hildebrand had played a leading part in ecclesiastical affairs. Throughout his career, he had but one objective in view, to impose upon all Christendom, from the emperor down, an unwavering obedience to the church, Sooner or later, therefore, a clash was inevitable. It came, unexpectedly, in Milan. In 1073, during a dispute over the vacant archbishopric, Henry's son, Henry IV, had aggravated matters by giving formal investiture to one candidate, while fully aware that Pope Gregory's predecessor, Alexander II, had already approved the canonical appointment of another. Here was an act of open defiance which the Church could not ignore, and in 1075, Gregory categorically condemned all ecclesiastical investiture by laymen, on pain of anathema. Whereupon the furious Henry immediately invested two more German bishops with Italian sees, adding, for good measure, a further Archbishop of Milan, although his former nominee was still alive. Refusing the papal summons to Rome to account for his actions, he then called a general council of all German bishops, and on 24 January 1076, formally deposed Gregory from the papacy. He had badly overplayed his hand. The Pope's answering deposition, accompanied by Henry's excommunication and the release of all his subjects from their allegiance, led to revolts throughout Germany, which brought the emperor literally to his knees. Crossing the Alps in midwinter with his wife and baby son, he found Gregory in January 1077 at the castle of Canossa, and there, after 3 days of abject humiliation, he at length received the absolution he needed. The story of Canossa, often enlivened by an illustration of the emperor barefoot and in sackcloth, shivering in the snow before the locked doors of the castle, has been a perennial favorite with German writers of children's history books, in which it is apt to appear as an improving object lesson in the vanity of temporal ambitions. In fact, Gregory's triumph was empty and ephemeral, and Henry knew it. He had no intention of keeping his promises of submission, and in 1081 he crossed into Italy once again, this time at the head of an army. At first, Rome held firm, but after 2 years, Henry managed to break through the defenses. A few half-hearted attempts at negotiation were soon abandoned, and on Easter Day, 1084, he had himself crowned emperor by his own nominee, the antipope Clement III. Even now, Gregory, entrenched in the castle St. Angelo, refused to surrender. He had one more card to play. The Normans, to whom he had always appealed when in trouble, had this time been slow to respond, Robert Guiscard being fully occupied with a Balkan campaign against the Eastern Empire. But in May 1084, Robert suddenly appeared with an army of 36,000 at the walls of Rome. Henry, hopelessly outnumbered, withdrew just in time. The Normans broke through the Porta Femenia, and for the next 3 days the city was given over to an orgy of pillage and slaughter. When at last peace was restored, the whole district between the Colosseum and the Lateran had been burned to the ground. Rome had suffered more from the champions of the Pope than she had ever had to endure from Goth or Vandal. Robert, not daring to leave the unhappy Gregory to the mercy of the populace, escorted him south to Salerno, where he died the following year. The Pope's last words, ironical and self-pitying, have come down to us. I have loved righteousness and hated iniquity, therefore I die in exile. It was a bitter valediction, but Gregory's achievement had been greater than he knew. He had finally established papal supremacy over the church hierarchy. The practice of lay investitures, already losing ground, was to die out altogether early in the following century. And even if he had not won similar victory over the empire, he had at least asserted his claims in such a way that they could never again be ignored. The church had shown her teeth. Future emperors would defy her at their peril. The events of the 11th century, and in particular, the weakening of the imperial hold on Italy as the investiture struggle gained momentum, provided the perfect climate for the development of the Lombard and Tuscan city-states. But while these fissile and republican tendencies were shaping the destinies of North Italy, the South was developing on opposite lines. Here, too, there existed trading cities such as Naples, Salerno, and Amalfi, with long histories of independence. Outside these, however, the energy of the Normans had welded the land together for the first time in five centuries, imposing on it an autocratic feudalism stricter than anything the North had ever known. Robert Guiscard died in 1085 on an expedition against Constantinople, leaving his mainland dominion to his son, but effective control in Sicily to his brother, now the great Count Rogier, who had been largely responsible for its conquest. It was a fortunate decision, since it enabled Rogier to consolidate the Norman hold on the island, where in certain areas Saracen resistance was still strong. In the 16 years that he was to survive his brother, he laid the foundations of a secure and brilliantly organized state, foundations on which his son was triumphantly to build. In Rogier II, Europe saw one of the greatest and most colorful rulers of the Middle Ages. Born of an Italian mother, raised in Sicily where, thanks to his father's principles of total religious toleration, Greek and Saracen mingled on equal footing with Norman and Latin. In appearance a southerner, in temperament an oriental, he had yet inherited all the ambition and energy of his Norman forebears and combined them with a gift for civil administration entirely his own. In 1127, he acquired the Norman mainland from an incapable and feckless cousin, thus becoming, in his own right, one of the leading rulers of Europe. Only one qualification was lacking before he could compete as an equal with his fellow princes. He desperately needed a crown. His opportunity came in February 1130, in the all-too-familiar guise of a dispute over the papal succession. Pope Honorius II was dying. His obvious successor was Cardinal Pietro Pierleone, former papal legate to Henry I of England, a cleric of outstanding ability and irreproachable Cluniac background, who, however, being a member of a rich and influential family of Jewish origins, was unacceptable to the extreme reformist section of the Curia. While the majority acclaimed Pierleone as Pope Anacletus II, this group elected its own candidate, who took the name Innocent II. Within a few days, Innocent's position became so dangerous that he was forced to leave Rome, but his departure proved his salvation. Once over the Alps, his cause, championed by one of the most disastrous and most disruptive political influences of the age, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, he rapidly gathered support from all Christian Europe. Anacletus was left with only Rome and Rogier. Rogier's terms were simple: Norman support in return for a crown. Instantly the Pope agreed, and so it was that on Christmas Day 1130, in conditions of unprecedented splendor, Rogier was crowned King of Sicily and Italy in the Cathedral of Palermo. His troubles, however, were not over. Anacletus died in 1138, and in the following year, Innocent, at last secure on his throne, himself led an army against the new kingdom. It was always a mistake for popes to meet Normans on the battlefield. Innocent was captured at the Garigliano River, just as Leo IX had been at Civitate, and received his liberty only on formally recognizing Rogier's title to the crown. But the king was too dangerous a threat to the southern frontier of the Papal States to allow of any real reconciliation. Neither were his relations with the two empires any happier. Both saw him as a challenge to their own sovereignty. And in 1146, even Rogier's superbly torturous diplomacy failed to prevent an entente of all three powers against him. He was saved only by the Second Crusade, that humiliating fiasco which was the price the princes of Europe paid for allowing Saint Bernard to meddle in their affairs. And yet, with all his problems, foreign and domestic, for the powerful vassals in Apulia, maintained a state of almost constant insurrection during much of his reign, Roger's power continued to grow, as did the magnificence of his court. The navy that he created under his brilliant admiral, George of Antioch, soon became, despite the hostility of the Italian Sea republics, paramount in the Mediterranean. Malta he conquered, and the North African coast from Tripoli to Tunis. Constantinople itself was raided, so were Corinth and Thebes, the latter the center of the Byzantine silk-weaving industry, whence captive artisans were brought back to staff the royal workshops in Palermo. Here, in his palaces and pavilions among the orange groves, Roger spent the last 10 years of his life working with his polyglot chancery. Latin, Greek, and Arabic were all official languages of the kingdom, discussing science and philosophy with the foremost international scholars of the time. For Sicily was now the main channel through which both Greek and Arabic learning passed into Europe. Or, taking his ease like any Oriental potentate in his splendidly stocked harem. His supreme monument is the Palatine Chapel, which he built during the 1130s and 1140s on the first floor of the Royal Palace of Palermo. In plan, it is on the traditional Latin model, with a central nave flanked by two aisles, and steps leading up into an apsid sanctuary. The floor and lower walls are Latin too, though of astonishing opulence and sumptuousness, their creamy white marble inlaid with gold leaf and polychrome opus alexandrinum. Every square inch of the upper walls, on the other hand, is completely covered with Byzantine mosaics, nearly all of the same date and of superb quality, clearly the work of Greek mosaicists, expressly imported from Constantinople. These alone would be enough to mark the chapel as a jewel, rare and utterly unique. But they are not alone. Soaring above them is a painted stalactite roof of purest Arabic workmanship, a roof that would do credit to Cordoba or Damascus. Roger's most astonishing political achievement was to weld together the three great civilizations of the Mediterranean, Latin, Greek, and Arab, so that they worked together in peace and harmony, and to do so in a century in which they were everywhere else at each other's throats. The century of the Crusades and less than 100 years after the great schism between Eastern and Western churches. Here in this one small building, we find that same achievement expressed quite spectacularly in visual terms. We see it too in the king's other great foundation at Cefalù. There, the Arabic influence may be rather less evident, but the holy Byzantine mosaic of Christ Pantocrator, the ruler of all, in the high eastern apse, is surely the greatest portrait of the Redeemer in all Christian art. Meanwhile, the wind of change, having already swept through northern Italy, was moving slowly south to Rome. In 1143, a civil insurrection broke out in the city, and a senate was once again established. The papacy fought back. In 1145, Pope Lucius II actually died of wounds sustained while storming the capital. But the communal movement steadily gained ground, particularly after the arrival of a certain Arnold of Brescia, a fiery young monk in whom an extreme aestheticism was buttressed by a new approach to religious thinking, scholastic philosophy. This had grown up during the past century in France under theologians such as Arnold's old master, Peter Abelard, and it was now taking root in Italy. Essentially, a trend away from the old mysticism towards a spirit of logical, rationalistic inquiry in spiritual matters. It was one of the two dominant influences in Arnold's life. The other was the revived interest in Roman law, now being expounded at the University of Bologna. From these two influences, he had developed his theory, which he preached tirelessly through the streets and piazzas of Rome, that the church should subject itself entirely in all things temporal to the civil authority of the state. renouncing all worldly power and reverting to the pure and uncompromising poverty of the early fathers. Here was dangerous stuff. To St. Bernard, who preached diametrically opposite views with equal force and who had already condemned Abelard and Arnauld together at the Great Council of Sens in 1140, it was anathema. But not even Bernard could loosen Arnauld's hold on Rome. This was to be the joint achievement of two other towering figures of their century, the Emperor Frederick Barbarossa and Nicholas Breakspear, who, as Pope Adrian, or Hadrian IV, was the only Englishman ever to occupy the throne of St. Peter. Adrian made it clear from the outset that he intended to take orders from no one. When, therefore, he found that the Roman Commune, supported by Arnauld, was barring him access to the Lateran, his reply was swift. Early in 1155, all Rome was placed under an interdict, to continue until Arnauld had been expelled from the city. No pope had ever dared to take such a step before, but it proved triumphantly successful. Holy Week was approaching, a godless Easter was unthinkable, and popular feeling rose sharply against the commune. Suddenly, Arnauld disappeared, and Adrian at last found himself free once more. On Easter Day, he presided as planned at High Mass in the Lateran. Frederick of Hohenstaufen, king of the Romans and thus emperor-elect since 1152, kept the feast at Pavia. He had recently received the Iron Crown of Lombardy in a ceremony even more symbolic than usual, since several of the Lombard towns, led by Milan, were now in open opposition to the empire, and was heading south to his imperial coronation in Rome. Near Siena, he was met by papal legates with an urgent request, his assistance in capturing Arnauld of Brescia, who had taken refuge in a neighboring castle. For Frederick's army, this presented no difficulty. Arnauld soon gave himself up and was returned to Rome. Condemned by the prefect of the city, he was first hanged, then burned. Finally, his ashes were cast into the Tiber. Still, the prospect of Frederick's imminent arrival in Rome was beginning to cause concern in the Curia. Not without difficulty, for neither party trusted the other an inch, a meeting was arranged between king and pope near Sutri. It nearly ended in fiasco when, for 2 days, Barbarossa refused to perform the symbolic act of holding Adrian's bridle and stirrup as he dismounted. But at last agreement was reached, and the two rode on to Rome together. They were soon intercepted by some tight-lipped envoys from the commune. If Frederick wished to enter the city, he would have to pay tribute and guarantee all the citizens their civic liberties. The king refused point blank, and the envoys sullenly returned. But Adrian, scenting trouble, quickly dispatched a heavy advance force to take over the Leonine city. The next morning, at first light, he and Frederick secretly slipped into Rome, and a few hours later the new emperor had been crowned. The news reached the commune while it was meeting to discuss how best to prevent the coronation. Furious at having been tricked, mob and militia together attacked the Vatican. All day the fighting went on, with heavy slaughter on both sides. But by evening the imperial forces had prevailed, and the remaining attackers withdrew across the river. Frederick, having got what he wanted, now returned to Germany. For Adrian, however, it had been an empty victory. Without the emperor's troops to protect him, he could not remain in Rome, and he failed utterly to mobilize Frederick's support against King William I, the Bad of Sicily, Roger II's son and successor, whom he still refused to recognize. His best hope of achieving the downfall of the Sicilian kingdom now lay with the Apulian barons, once again in revolt and this time supported by a Byzantine army. But his luck had deserted him. William did not deserve his nickname, which seems to have been more due to his swarthy and sinister appearance and his Herculean physical strength than to any serious defects of character. True, he was lazier and still more pleasure-loving than his father, but he had retained the Hopeville gift of galvanizing himself and all those around him when faced with a crisis. He now swept up from Sicily at the head of his Saracen shock troops, smashed the Greeks and the Apulian insurgents at Brindisi, and then went on to besiege Adrian at Benevento. For the third time, the Normans had a great pope at their mercy. In June 1156, forced to capitulate, Adrian confirmed William in his Sicilian kingdom. Humiliating as it was, the pope soon had cause to be glad of his action, for Barbarossa was proving more of a menace to the papacy than William had ever been. During the summer of 1158, he returned to Italy in strength, and at the Diet of Roncalia, left the Italian cities in no doubt as to his own concept of imperial sovereignty, as four celebrated savants from Bologna, a university to which he had always shown especial favor, demolished all their beloved ideals of municipal independence, showing them to be totally devoid of legal foundation. Henceforth, he declared, every city would be subjected, through a foreign governor, Podesta, to complete imperial control. Throughout Lombardy, the effect was electric, but Frederick had come prepared for trouble. In 1159, at Crema, he tied 50 hostages, including children, to his siege engines to prevent the defenders from counterattacking. In 1162, he at last brought the Milanese to their knees and destroyed their city so completely that for the next 5 years it lay deserted and in ruins. But he only stiffened the city's resistance. Past rivalries now forgotten, they formed the Great Lombard League to defend their liberties. Pope Adrian had died in 1159. Clearly, from Frederick's point of view, much depended on the choice of his successor, and he was well aware that by far the most likely candidate was Cardinal Roland Bandinelli, who was, like Adrian, strongly opposed to his claims. To what degree he was responsible for what followed is uncertain. It can only be said that the investiture, which was held 2 days after Roland's election in St. Peter's on 7 September, was the most grotesquely undignified in papal history. The scarlet mantle of the papacy was produced, and the new pope, after the customary display of reluctance, bent his head to receive it. At that moment, Cardinal Octavian of St. Cecilia suddenly dived at him, snatched the mantle, and tried to don it himself. A scuffle ensued, during which he lost it again, but his chaplain instantly brought forward another, having presumably foreseen just such an eventuality, which Octavian this time managed to put on. Unfortunately, back to front before anyone could stop him. There followed a scene of scarcely believable confusion. Wrenching himself free from the furious supporters of Roland, who were trying to tear the mantle forcibly from his back, Octavian, whose frantic efforts to turn it right way round had succeeded only in getting the fringes tangled around his neck, made a dash for the papal throne, sat on it, and proclaimed himself Pope Victor IV. He then charged off through the basilica until he found a group of minor clergy, whom he ordered to give him their acclamation, which, seeing the doors burst open and a band of armed cutthroats swarming into the church, they obediently did. For the moment, at least, the opposition was silenced. Roland and his adherents slipped out while they could and took refuge in the fortified tower of St. Peter's. Meanwhile, with the cutthroats looking on, Octavian was enthroned a little more formally than on the previous occasion and escorted in triumph to the Lateran, having, we are told, been at some pains to adjust his dress before leaving. However undignified its execution, the coup could now be seen to have been meticulously planned in advance, and on a scale that left no doubt that the empire must have been actively implicated. Octavian had long been known as an imperial sympathizer, and his election was immediately recognized by Frederick's two ambassadors in Rome, who at the same time launched a vigorous campaign against Roland. This proved unsuccessful, Before long, public opinion in Rome swung firmly behind the rightful pope, who on 20 September, at the little town of Ninfa, at last received his formal consecration as Pope Alexander III. The church remained effectively in schism, but gradually Octavian lost his support. He died in 1164 in Lucca, where he had been keeping alive on the proceeds of not very successful brigandage, and where the local hierarchy would not even allow him burial within the walls. Venice, Sicily, and, as soon as he was able, Pope Alexander lent their active support to the Lombard League, and soon Frederick began to feel, for the first time, the full weight of Italian opposition. Soon, too, his luck began to turn. In 1167, a march on Rome was brought to nothing when plague broke out in the imperial city. The emperor was obliged to retreat, almost defenseless through hostile Lombardy, and barely managed to drag his pale survivors back over the Alps. In 1174, he returned, but the momentum had gone. On 29 May 1176, his German knights were routed at Legnano by the forces of the League. It was the end of Frederick's ambitions in Lombardy. At the Congress of Venice in the following year, he publicly kissed Pope Alexander's foot at the entrance of St. Mark's, and in 1183, at Constance, the Venetian truce became a treaty. Though imperial suzerainty was technically preserved, the cities of Lombardy and, to some extent, Tuscany also, were henceforth free to manage their own affairs. It was hardly the solution Frederick had foreseen at Roncalia. But consolation was soon at hand. The empire, which had fought so vainly and so long for control over Lombardy, was now to acquire Sicily with hardly a struggle. Rogi II, who died in 1154, was unfortunate in his descendants. His son, William the Bad, despite his triumph over the Pope, had a basically undistinguished reign of only 12 years, after which he was succeeded in turn by his son, William II. Genetically, the new king was a throwback. Unlike his father, who was described as a huge ogre of a man, whose thick black beard lent him a savage and terrible aspect which filled many people with fear, the younger William was fair-haired and outstandingly handsome. It was somehow inevitable that he should be called William the Good, though in fact as a ruler he turned out to be rather worse than his father, weak and ineffectual, always striving after effect but hardly ever achieving it. His only true inheritance from Rogi was a passion for building, and his immense cathedral of Monreale on the hills above Palermo, the vast expanse of its interior walls a blaze of dazzling mosaic, stands as an unforgettable monument to Sicily's last legitimate Norman king. For when William the Good died, aged 36, on 18 November 1189, the Hopefield line died out. His wife, Joanna, she was the daughter of Henry II of England, had borne him no children, and the throne passed to, of all people, his aunt, Constance, the posthumous daughter of Rogi II. She was, in fact, a year younger than her nephew, the king, who, nearly 4 years before, had been given in marriage to Henry, son and heir of Frederick Barbarossa. Why William and his advisers had ever contemplated such an idea for a moment will never be understood, since it meant that were the king to die childless, Sicily would fall into the emperor's lap, its separate existence at an end. Admittedly, there was plenty of time yet for Joanna to conceive. In 1186, she was still only 20, her husband 32. But life in the 12th century was a good deal more uncertain than it is today. Infant mortality was high, and to take such a risk before the succession was properly assured was, by any standards, an act of almost criminal folly. There were, it need hardly be said, many Norman barons bitterly opposed to Constance and determined to fight, if necessary, for the kingdom's continued independence. Early in 1190, with the encouragement of Pope Clement III, the Archbishop of Palermo laid the crown of Sicily on the head of Rogi II's illegitimate grandson, Tancred, Count of Lecce. Tancred was small and villainously ugly, and his illegitimacy should technically have debarred him from the throne. But he was able and energetic, and had he lived a normal lifespan and managed to find just one strong ally apart from the Pope, there is just a chance that he might have saved his country from extinction. Sadly, he had half the Norman barons against him, and was faced from the start with widespread rebellion. Moreover, he was to die in early middle age. His son and successor, still a child, was powerless when Henry, now the Emperor Henry VI, arrived in 1194 to claim his crown. He too was to die in mysterious circumstances soon afterwards. Henry's coronation took place in Palermo on Christmas Day 1194 and brought the most dazzling realm of the Middle Ages all too prematurely to its end. 64 years is a short life for a kingdom. And indeed, Sicily might have survived had William II, his sobriquet is better forgotten, shown himself either sensible or fertile. Instead, he made a present of it to its oldest and most persistent enemy, who, on the pretext of a suspected conspiracy, was to massacre virtually all the Sicilian and South Italian noblemen who had opposed him just 4 days after his coronation, instituting a reign of terror that was to last for the rest of his life. The Norman kingdom of Sicily was never defeated. It was thrown away. For one more generation, however, the spirit lived on. Queen Constance had not been present when her husband was crowned in Palermo. Pregnant for the first time at the age of 40, she was determined on two things. First, that her child should be born safely. Second, that it should be seen to be unquestionably hers. She did not put off her journey to Sicily, but traveled more slowly and in her own time. She had got no further than the little town of Jesi, some 20 miles west of Ancona, when she felt the pains of childbirth upon her. There, on the day after the coronation, in a tent erected in the main square to which free entry was allowed to any matron of the town who cared to witness the birth, she brought forth her only son, whom a day or two later she presented in that same square to the assembled inhabitants, proudly suckling the baby at her breast. Of that son, Frederick, later to be nicknamed Stupor Mundi, the astonishment of the world, we shall hear more, much more, as our story continues. Chapter 7. The Christian Counterattack. After the Muslims had conquered Spain in the 8th century and the greater part of Sicily in the 9th, they made no further permanent territorial acquisitions. To the Christian lands surrounding the Mediterranean, however, they seemed a more horrible threat than ever. Their unofficial colonies in the south of Italy and in southern France were the terror of their Christian neighbors. No area of the Middle Sea was safe from the danger of their pirate fleets, and there were few coastal towns or cities that did not live in fear of a surprise onslaught. Venice, almost alone, secure in her shallow lagoon, had no need for vigilance. Rome itself, as we have seen, had been sacked in 846, and in the following century, Genoa and Pisa suffered similar fates. Nor was the Muslim menace confined to piracy. Egypt was also becoming increasingly dangerous. A Turkish soldier of fortune, Ahmed ibn Talun, became governor in 868 and extended his authority through much of the Levant as far as Sicilia, in the southeastern corner of the coast of Asia Minor. Finally, in the last years of the century, the Abbasid Caliph sent a punitive fleet to Egypt, and the Talunid rule ended in 905. 3 decades of confusion followed, after which another considerably more distinguished and longer-lasting dynasty took the stage, the Fatimids, Shias of the Ismaili sect, who traced their descent to the Prophet's daughter, Fatima. First coming into prominence in Tunisia, they conquered Egypt in 969 and built themselves a new capital, which they named Al-Kahira, the Victorious, known to us today as Cairo. By this time, the Abbasid Caliphate was on its last legs and unable to prevent the Fatimid conquest not only of Palestine and Syria, but also of the Arabian heartlands, the Hejaz. In theory, from the 9th century onward, it was the Western emperor who bore the ultimate responsibility for defending his empire from infidel attack. But the emperor was powerless. Aachen, the imperial capital, was several weeks' march from the Mediterranean. Even when an army ventured south, it was, perforce, confined to the land, since the few vessels that constituted the imperial navy normally found themselves in the Baltic. Poor Otto II was a case in point. In December 980, he had decided to free South Italy once and for all from the Saracen scourge. To begin with, his campaign had gone well enough, but in the summer of 982, as he was advancing to Calabria, he had been surprised by an Arab force near Stilo. His army had been cut to pieces, and he himself had escaped only by swimming to a passing ship, concealing his identity and later, as the vessel approached Rossano, jumping overboard again and striking out for the shore. His defeat was the clearest possible illustration of imperial powerlessness in the face of Islamic pressure. Yet even then, though still almost imperceptibly, the pendulum had begun its backward swing. From the late 10th century onward, we see a slow increase in Christian resistance. The Muslim settlers in the south of France were expelled by 975. Genoa and Pisa were building up navies of their own. Already by 1016, these enabled them to band together to drive the Saracens from the island of Sardinia, which since 721 had suffered at least 9 major raids, often accompanied by massacres of the local population. Not many years later, the Arabs of North Africa were given a taste of their own medicine, as Italian ships began in their turn to threaten the coastal towns. By the end of the 50-year rule of the Byzantine Emperor Basil II, the Bulgar Slayer, in 1025, his empire had regained control of virtually the entire Balkan Peninsula, all Asia Minor, Apulia, Crete, and Cyprus. The grand climacteric came in 1087, when Genoa and Pisa made another joint expedition, this time against Mahdia, the Arab capital, in what is now Tunisia, capturing the town, burning the ships in its harbor, and imposing peace terms on its ruler. 4 years later, the great Count Rogier I completed his conquest of Sicily, and in 1092 and 1093, further expeditions from Italy and southern France joined a substantial force of Normans to reconquer much of northern Spain. On every side, the Muslim world was breaking up. Politically, the Mediterranean was once again becoming a Christian sea. But there was bad news, too. In 1055, the first wave of Turkish invaders, the Seljuks, had captured Baghdad. In 1071, they had burst into Asia Minor. The Byzantine Emperor Romanus IV Diogenes had personally led an army against them, but on 26 August he had been soundly defeated and taken prisoner at the Battle of Manzikert. The Seljuk leader, Alp Arslan, whose mustaches, we are told, were so long that he had to have them tied behind his back when hunting, had treated the emperor handsomely and sent him back with an escort to Constantinople. But the damage was done. In the years that followed, the Turks spread all over central Anatolia, leaving only parts of the coast in Byzantine hands. 14 years after the battle in 1085, they captured Antioch, the third of the 5 patriarchates of the Eastern Church, after Alexandria and Jerusalem, to fall to the Muslims. Only Rome and Constantinople remained. The story of this first wave of Turkish expansion in Anatolia had one important and quite unexpected consequence. The Seljuk conquest of Armenia, far to the northeast, centered on Mount Ararat, led to a huge southward exodus on the part of its people, and in 1080, a certain Rupen, a relative of the last king of Anai, found a small principality in the heart of the Taurus in Sicilia. Gradually, though it was the best part of 1,000 miles from the Armenian heartland, this grew in strength and importance until, in 1199, it was to become the kingdom of Lesser Armenia. The Armenians have always prided themselves on being the first nation in the world to adopt Christianity, which they did in about 300 AD. Here, suddenly, was a Christian kingdom virtually surrounded by Muslim states, hostile to Byzantium, but shortly to give invaluable support to the Crusaders, above all those of the First Crusade, on their way through Cilicia to the Holy Land. In the immediate aftermath of Manzikert, it was all the more to be expected that Western Christendom should turn its attention to the Muslim East. The Italian coastal cities were attracted by the obvious commercial possibilities. The Normans were, as always, impelled by their deep-seated surge for conquest and adventure. But militant Christians, wherever they might be, were determined somehow to stem the Muslim tide. Thus, when Pope Urban II addressed the Council of Clermont on 27 November 1095 and concluded his speech with an impassioned appeal for a crusade, he was preaching to the already half-converted, providing religious justification for an enterprise which might well have been launched without him. The continued occupation of the holy places and, above all, of Jerusalem itself by the infidel was, he declared, an affront to Christendom. Christian pilgrims were now being subjected to every kind of humiliation and indignity. It was the duty of all good Christians to take up arms against those who had desecrated the ground upon which Christ had trod, and to recover it for their own true faith. In the months that followed, Urban's words were carried by the Pope himself through France and Italy, and by a whole army of preachers to every corner of Western Europe. The response was tremendous. From as far afield as Scotland, men hastened to take the cross. Neither the Emperor, Henry IV, nor King Philip I of France, who had recently been excommunicated for adultery, were on sufficiently good terms with Rome to join the crusade. But this was perhaps just as well. Urban was determined that the great enterprise should be under ecclesiastical control, and nominated as leader and his official legate one of the relatively few churchmen to have already made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, Bishop Adhemar of Lepuy. The bishop was to be accompanied, however, by several powerful magnates: Raymond of Saint-Guy, Count of Toulouse, the oldest, richest, and most distinguished of them all; the French king's brother, Count Hugh of Vermandois, who arrived severely shaken after a disastrous shipwreck in the Adriatic; Count Robert II of Flanders; Duke Robert of Normandy, son of William the Conqueror; and his cousin, Count Stephen of Blois; and Godfrey de Bouillon, Duke of Lower Lorraine. With Godfrey came his brother Baldwin of Bouillonnais, who, as a younger son without a patrimony, had brought along his wife and children and was determined to carve out a kingdom for himself in the east. From South Italy came Bohemond, Prince of Taranto, son of Robert Giscard, who cherished similar ambitions. True Norman that he was, he cared little for the holy places, but looked on the crusade as the greatest adventure of his life. One of the most popular leaders, however, was not a nobleman at all, but an elderly, itinerant monk called Peter, nicknamed the Hermit. For the hermit's cape, that so far as could be seen, he never removed. He stank to high heaven, and was said to look almost exactly like the donkey that he always rode. But his personal magnetism was undeniable. According to the historian Guibert of Nogent, whatever he said or did seemed like something half divine. He had preached the crusade all over France and in much of Germany, and by the time his particular expedition set out, he may have had a following of over 40,000. Many of these doubtless were sincere, God-fearing men, eager to fight for the sacred cause. But there were also large numbers of sick and lame, including women and children, who hoped for miraculous cures, while the vast majority seemed to have been footloose riffraff, attracted only by the possibility of plunder and by the